Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and my very own shoddy shyster, it's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, my shoddy shyster, how are you, Dave?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, not bad. Enjoying the sun. It's quite liberating, isn't it?
It's nice. It feels like summer has finally landed after a long, cold winter. I'll tell you what, I'm
struggling with at the moment. There's like Spring Watch started the other day. Spring started ages ago, did it not?
I think that. Isn't spring kind of March time?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And this is as good as what? Listen, it's going to be June this week, isn't it? And then it's going to be like proper summer. I don't know. And the years just fly by, Jason. But then that makes us sound old, doesn't it?
Yes. Anyway, swiftly moving on from that. So we got a great guest today.
We have indeed.
So our guest today is a man who's been looking after our best interests for decades now. He's a TV presenter and a journalist, and he's not afraid to take people on and bring them to account. He's the consumer champion who's best known for telly shows, Fake Britain, Cowboy Builders, and Don't Get Done, Get Dom. It is, of course, Mr. Dominic Littlewood. Hi, mate. How are you?
Yeah, I feel privileged to be on your show, guys. I'm very well, thank you.
Good.
Well, listen, sunshine is that you're talking about. It's not where I am. It's freezing here.
Well, you showed us a little picture out of your window just before, Dom, and yeah, you're right. You're not having the same weather that we are where you are.
No, it's Arctic.
No, behave yourself. I mean, you want to get a hat on.
Well, actually, I'll tell you what, you know, there's a lot to be said for losing your head. Really, you know, they say it, and it's true. When I go out, I'm wearing a hat when others are, you know, are quite happy and comfortable.
You lose it all from your head, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what they say.
You'll find this out one day. Honestly, guys, you know, when all that's gone, you know what I'm talking about.
Or your feet. My feet are my radiator. They're my kind of thermostat. If my feet get hot, then I boil up. And if I take my socks and shoes off, they instantly cool down and I cool down. Hence why there's socks all around my gaff, stuck down the sofa, do you know what I mean? Because I'm like, get them off, I get too hot. But I find my feet are what regulates my temperature.
It's becoming like an episode of Loose Men, this, already. I mean, we're supposed to be talking about motoring issues. But anyway, before we get on to that, Dominic Littlewood, obviously, you've been a household name for many, many decades. How did it all begin? How did you end up being, effectively, probably the best-known consumer champion on the telly?
Well, I was always very good at fighting consumer battles way, way, way before being in TV. And what happened is the way I never ever wanted to be in telly in my life, never looked for it, never applied for it, never went for a job interview. What happened is my girlfriend at the time saw this advert for a TV program, and it was called The Other Half with Dale Winton. And I didn't want to go on it. And she said, let's do it. And she was a cracking looking girl at the time. She was, you know, she was, let's put it politely, she was a model, but, you know, she used to take her clothes off if you get the, you know, get the picture.
Right, okay.
She was stunning looking. And the idea of this program was four girls go into a show, all claiming to be my girlfriend, and only one of them is, she tells the truth. And the other three were all sort of pretending. And I thought, okay, it's a bit of fun. They'll never put us together. So we went on this show and they came around and they filmed little clues in my house and what have you. And we literally did it for a bit of a giggle, went on, didn't go through to the next round because they put the two of us together. So the other couple went through and that was the end of it. But as a result of that, I then found that people saw me on telly and there was a really cracking BBC primetime series that was being created. I don't know if you remember it at the time. It was called Wrong Car, Right Car. It was my look. They came along and said to me, would you be interested in this program? And I said, absolutely not. Not in a million years. You know, all you're going to do, as you always do with, you know, with people in telly, as you say, we put sawdust in gearboxes and we clock cars and this, that and the other. And I was in the motor trade. I had my own garage at the time, sales garage. And I thought all you're going to do is just, you know, use me and chew me up, spit me out. And that's it. But actually, it wasn't. It was a good program. It was a cracking program. They talked me into it. And I did it. It was in my early 30s. And I really enjoyed it. And it was a massive success. And it went straight through to...
Dom, was that with Jason Barlow?
Yes.
I thought it might have been.
Jason was the main man in the programme because he was a motoring journalist. He'd done a bit of Top Gear, and he still is a very well-respected journalist, as you know. But inadvertently, what happened is because we were trying to help people buy cars, I sort of ended up taking a bit more limelight than probably was expected. Because there I was, this bald-headed, ugly, you know, guy looks like I've been chasing parked buses, suddenly come on the screen with... you know, with a bit of personality and I was a bit of a cheeky chap and people just liked the programme and it was very, very popular. I think poor old Jason probably felt a little bit wounded. And I hope he didn't because, you know, we were great friends throughout it. We had a lovely time and he was a cracking presenter. And he sort of held my hand and showed me through the programme. But it became popular. I think people liked the cheekiness of me at the time. I was, you know, just a hardworking, you know, regular guy. Yeah. So the program was successful and it went to series two and it always got good viewing figures. Before I knew it, I was launched into this showbiz life and I actually started to like it. Now, I'm not interested. I know it sounds odd. I'm really not interested in being recognised. It drives me potty. Can't stand it. You know, people, you know, interfering in your personal life all the time. It does happen. We all know what it's like. But the opportunities the job gave me, you know, traveling, and I've socialized with Dolly Parton. I mean, when's that ever like you out to an ex-car dealer from Essex, you know? And it opened up loads of doors, and I really lapped up the work. But what the BBC particularly, like I have worked on all channels, started to realize is that I was a people person. People like me, they can relate to me. I'm not the son of Judith Chalmers or, you know, public school educated and talk with a plum on my voice. I'm a regular, hardworking, honest guy. And for that reason, the consumer side of things started to, you know, to come into more effect. And it's something which I was doing way before TV. You know, I took a company to court when I was in my early 20s. Yeah, how many people do you know who've done that in their life?
Yeah, absolutely.
Lo and behold, I won the court case and proved to them that the David and Goliath story, you know, don't always think that just because I'm a member of the public or you're a member of the public, whatever, that, you know, we have to bow down to your rules. And, you know, it's one of those things I've always said to people, you know, we always say, oh, you know, these companies, when they argue about things, they say it's in the T's and C's. And I say, but T's and C's are law. It's that company's lawyer's version of what they want to be, how they want to treat you.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's almost like a boilerplate, isn't it? It's just a boilerplate at the bottom of a letter. Exactly. It doesn't actually mean anything.
And it's the same as guarantees. You know, you go to a company with something wrong and they say, well, it's out of warranty. You say, oh, hang on a second. You know, warranty is not your statutory right. You know, when a company gives you a year's guarantee on a telly and it's out of warranty 13 months later, that's irrelevant. That warranty is a gift. It's a bonus. It's an added extra. Your rights, your law, your statutory rights is the sale of goods act. You've actually got 6 years cover. There's caveats to that. But you've got 6 years cover on things. You know, the amount of times I catch these companies off guard, and the BBC capitalised on that. They threw me at the deep end and said, let's do consumer programmes. And I did. And a lot of people learnt a lot from it and have saved themselves a fortune. And also a lot of companies.
Yeah.
You know, I've had companies before on the phone. One particular company said, we use your programmes as training videos for our staff.
Is that right?
You know? Yeah. You know,
that's a hell of a compliment, though, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is. And a lot of companies have learnt, you know, from some of the knowledge that I have and just really just being somebody who, if something's not right, I will look into it and if it, you know, and I'll try and put it right. Not to embarrass companies, to educate them.
Don't get done, get dumb.
Yeah. Although I will say, JP, I went to a nightclub once and a girl came up to me. And she said, you were my first. And I said, really? And she said, yeah, I got done by Dom. I said, well, I wouldn't look at it like that. I said, you know,
that's going to make a really sweet edit point for Dave. There it is.
Yeah, there's a lot of ammunition in a programme. That programme ran for about 11 years. And, you know, I'm lining myself up for some stick there, aren't I, really?
Hey, so I've got a question for you. And it leads on to what happened after. It leads on during the, you know, filming of the Don't Get Done, Get Dom. So my question is, what's more scary, going into a dodgy lockup where there's Alsatians all over the gaff and fronting up some pretty unsavory people, or stepping onto the Strictly dance floor?
But the funny thing is about Strictly is everybody assumes that it turns you into a dancer. No, it doesn't. What you do is you're in a routine for 90 seconds, right? And your dancer supports you, and you know, you follow her movements and what have you. But you know, if I went out now and someone said, do the jive, I couldn't do the jive. I couldn't if Lilia turned up, my ex-dancer, and said, let's do that routine we practiced for a whole week, you know, in and out, until it becomes, you know, embedded in your memory. But you know, I couldn't dance. And it doesn't teach you dancing. It teaches you routines.
Yeah, right. That's interesting.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah.
You know, it's effectively it's like a memory thing, isn't it? In that respect, exactly what you're saying, it's actually a memory challenge if you look at it that way. So you're not learning to dance per se, but you've got an entire week with your partner to learn a routine and perfect it to the best of your ability. Yeah,
but surely it gives you, you know, a better feel and rhythm for music. Surely you learn, you know, you improve that
without a doubt, Jason. You definitely your routines definitely get better because you start to learn how you might have to join your fingers and point them in a certain direction, or your toes be on your ball or your heel, etc. Me, I've got no ear for music. I love it. I listen to rock music, my Guns N' Roses, my AC/DC all the time, but I couldn't play a note, and I certainly can't dance. Now, I was given a reputation for looking at Lilia, my dancer's backside, and they kept saying that, you know, I was a bottom watcher. Now, okay, she had an amazing derriere, but trust me, when you're standing in front of 12 million, when you're sitting in front, or you're back in front of 12 million people, the last thing on your mind is, you know, is how perky someone's backside is. What I was doing was looking at her feet, knowing that when her foot moved, I had to move, rather than listening for the music, is when you should be moving your feet. So I was doing it wrong.
I'm buying that.
That's a great line.
I'm having that. I'm writing that down. I was looking at her feet, my lord.
Tesco's.
I was waiting for her feet.
I didn't want to move until she did.
Yeah, definitely. But brilliant job. Funny enough, my dancing was pretty lousy. But I'm type 1 diabetic, have 48 years. And in one of our rehearsals once, you got these people who are filming in the background, as you know, they're looking for anything that's funny that might happen. And all of a sudden, one of the camera girls stopped and she said, Dominic, check your sugar levels. And I said, they're fine. She said, no, check your sugar levels. I said, no, they're fine. And she said, I'd like you to check. And I thought she was doing it as part of the program. So I said, okay, then. So I checked my sugar levels. And at the time, I was practicing the jive, which is very energetic. Lo and behold, my sugar levels were down. They were in the 1 point something. I mean, it was really, really dangerously low.
Yeah. Dangerously low.
Yeah. I mean, you're on the verge of going into a coma at this stage. So I sort of collapsed on the floor, and they quickly got me some high sugar drinks and sweets and things. And the thing about diabetes is you can come out of it very quickly as long as you get high impact sugar in you. And I came out of it and I said to this girl, I've had diabetes almost all my life. I said, how did you see that I was low and I didn't feel that coming on? And she said, to be honest with you, Dominic, she said, it was the first time you've ever actually looked like you could dance. And when you think about it, you're going all floppy.
Dom, you said before that you're in the motor trade, so we know that was a big part of your life. So you've obviously got a basic interest in cars. Where did that first stem from? You know, what are your earliest memories of cars? Was it stuff as a little boy? Was your dad into cars?
My dad wasn't into cars. I come from a family of four kids and two parents who both had double jobs. They sort of worked all the time. For me, I'm a red-blooded guy. I started on motorbikes when I was 10 years old. And my parents had a rather large, I'd say garden, but it's more like a parcel of land. And I used to ride around on this 80cc bike around the garden and became a very good rider. So I was very much into my motocross and my scramble up until about the age of 16, 17. Then I went out on the road, had my first accident. As you always, it's inevitable on the road. At the age of 17, I just went into cars. I started off with a Mark II Cortina 1600E. I mean, what a cracking car for a 17-year-old lad to have as a starting car. I just loved it, adored it. But, you know, it was white. pinstripes were put all over the doors and it was jacked up at the back. And, you know, when you think about the things you did to the cars in those days, it was horrendous, really. But I was an apprentice, yeah, a City and Guilds mechanic. You know, that's my first job when I left school.
Okay.
Yeah, it was my second job when I left school. But I was never any good at it, you know, but I tinkered around a lot with the cars and sort of had a big passion. I still do for certain cars, not really European ones anymore, but, you know, I still have a passion for odd and unusual cars.
So, Dom, you know, over the years, you've managed to keep hold of any of the old cars?
And I haven't, but as a sort of young teenager, I fell in love with my boss's car, and it was an RS2000. He had an expat one with boxed-out arches. It was stunning. And I actually managed to buy one a few years ago. It wasn't the expat. It was just an RS2000 custom. And I picked it up and I drove it back. And all my childhood memories from it, or my teenage memories, were destroyed. It was not an enjoyable drive.
Really?
Really?
I pulled up at the lights and a Mini Clubman pulled up alongside me. It was twice the size of this RS2000. They were a lot smaller than you realise. And I just remember being very disappointed, hardly drove it, put it in the garage. And it sort of, it burst my bubble, and I sold it a couple of years later. I made a nice profit on it because those things are going through the roof now. It shattered it a little bit.
So, Dom, did you pass first time, your test?
Yeah, and I only had four lessons. Yeah, I was quite natural behind the wheel. But I was living in a tiny little village called Heybridge Basin, and I was doing an apprenticeship as a mechanic, and it was a 40-mile journey each way. And my dad, he put me on L plates and he sat alongside me, and I drove to work every day. So I didn't need a lot of lessons, and he was a good instructor. So, sailed through that, luckily as well.
Do you know what? We talk about this a lot, actually. That feeling of passing your test is something that I don't think you ever, ever forget. I mean, especially if you're into cars like we all are, because I always remember, and it was just glancing left. I remember when I passed my test, and I passed it first time, and then my Auntie Carol had a Mark I blue Fiesta, right, which she let me drive.
Yeah.
And I can remember the first time I took this out on my own and just being sat on the drive and looking to your left, and that passenger seat is empty. And you're kind of thinking, this is just me. And it's just the greatest feeling of freedom, isn't it? Because that, in effect, and I know it's a cliche, but that's the point at which you learn to drive. Because you don't really learn to drive properly when you've got somebody next to you. You have to actually just get out there and get some hours under your belt, don't you? And that's when you learn to drive, and that's when you make your own mistakes. But that feeling of freedom is just incredible.
Well, you actually feel like you are stepping a little bit further down the train. You're going from a teenager to a young man now, aren't you?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you're your own boss. If you want to, you know, go around your friend's house, you haven't got to go to mum and dad and ask for a lift.
Yeah.
You know, it's a massive feeling of liberation.
I must admit, I'm a taxi driver a lot at the moment. My eldest is 15, and she's her Bezzy mate is an hour away in the car, and she's down on the south coast at West Wittering. And of course, you know, the sun's up. Oh, Dad, can you take me down there? And I'm like, man, that's like 2 hours. Can you not get like a closer mate? She's got a year and a half until she starts thinking about driving. And then the question is, do I then teach her? And she said no. She said, Dad, you can't teach me, which is a bit of a relief because I'll find that really tough.
Yeah.
Obviously, because I've done a bit of driving over the years.
You've done a bit of driving over the years, but I'm in the same position. I've started to think about this as well because my daughter is 15. She turned 16 in August. So I'm already thinking about, I even thought about recently buying an old banger, right? Yeah. For me to kind of have now for the next year, just for doing all the local stuff, right? Rather than lumping my thing around. And then she could then sort of have that. So I've started looking at little kind of 1 liter courses and all this kind of stuff, little kind of local runaround things. But also that same question of can I or will I or indeed should I teach her to drive, or should I just stay well out of it and actually let a professional do it?
I've got none of those problems. I'm going to worry about them passing. I'm going to worry about buying them a car. No, I'm a bachelor boy. So we're with missus. We never bother with the kids. We haven't got that problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But do you know what I mean, Jason? It's like I worry that we'll fall out. and it'll be counterproductive.
Well, I'm definitely not going to. Definitely not going to teach you how to drive. I mean, I might do the last bit. I might just, you know, do kind of a refresher appraisal, like, oh, you got to do this. But
yeah,
all that stuff in the middle, we'll just have a ruck.
Yeah, no, because
you know what? She'll turn around and she'll say, I'll say, look, do it like this. And then she'll go, yeah, in your opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I'll be, ooh, I think my opinion might be right, actually. And then we'll kick off. So, and yeah, then, but yeah, I do you... like the idea about buying a little runaround and stick. I like that.
It's my new obsession. The thing is, because I love looking for cars, right? And I think we're all like this. I love, you know, it's one of my favorite things. Like, if anybody is after something, I'd be like, right, I'll go on Auto Trader and look for you. And I can spend hours on there. I mean, bearing in mind, I'm the same bloke who, before it was all online, if I was on a train journey, we've talked about this before, Jason, yeah, I think. Yeah. If I was on a train journey, rather than buying a copy of whatever magazine or, you know, football magazine or a car magazine or whatever, I would buy a paper copy of the Auto Trader, right? And just read it from cover to cover. I wasn't buying anything, but I would just read it. I found it really, really interesting. So now that I've got my little pet project, I'm thinking, what do I do? Do I go for a little 1.2 Fiesta? Do I go for a 1 litre Corsa? Do I go for something like a Micra or a Suzuki Swift or something? It's my new thing.
Whatever you do, don't go for a Ford Ka.
No.
Because they're very ugly. Don't go for the ugliest car in the world, which is a PT Cruiser.
Oh, I'm never going to near that.
I mean, that's a filthy thing, isn't it?
Jason, PT Cruiser, I'll give you that. But, you know, I actually went over to America. I flew over to Philadelphia, and I purchased a Plymouth Prowler in its day, which is a custom car version. And the PT is based loosely on that. Oh, come on. What are you putting a face like that for?
He hates them.
The Plymouth Prowler was gorgeous. Do you not think it's got the perfect shape for future hot rodding? It's one of those vehicles. It's almost a sit up and beg. It's bigger at the back end. You can flare the arches, put big wheels on it, a nice V8 lump in it, and have a stunning looking hot rod.
I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying, because it does sort of have that sort of slight look about it. But I think they're awful looking things. Well, I'm with Jason.
I've not seen one at all in the last 4 or 5 years. I think everyone's woken up and looked out the window and gone, no, that's got to go.
What was that other horrible, horrible thing that we've talked about before? Was it a horrible Fiat with the lights on the top sort of
roof? Yeah, I know the one that looks like got a face like a dolphin a bit.
Fiat Multipler, something that's like that. One. Awful, yeah. Awful looking thing.
But I tell you what, though. I can remember back in the Driven days, we reviewed one and loved it to drive because it had three proper seats in the front.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. So what's the daily drive at the moment then, Dom? Or is there a fleet of
No. I don't do a lot of mileage, but I'm very, very passionate about American cars. Now, I've imported brand spanking new cars from America and used cars.
Yeah.
And most of my life, I'd get excited about things that were sort of more unusual. Now, for me at the moment, I drive a Wrangler Jeep Rubicon, which is the big, meaty off-road version. It's in a colour called Mojito, which is like a really bright, luminous green. It's stunning looking head turning. Anybody who drives cars for a living, like you guys, would hate it. You know, it's got big wheels on it. It's very noisy. It's uncomfortable. The steering wheel doesn't recenter when you go around corners because of how big the tyres are. But for me, it's the fifth Jeep I've had throughout my life. I started off with CJ7s. I love them. I absolutely love them. I'm not interested in refinements and speed and showy offy cars, as in, you know, your big sports cars. I like unusual, rough and ready, and quirky cars. I've had loads of Americans throughout my life, and I really do like them. They're built like crap. We know that. That's the Americans. Not that they've built anything good. But as for style and looks, I think the Americans have always done it.
Yeah, well, do you know what? That Wrangler, it's not a bad bit of kit for an off-roader, like a true proper off-roader.
You know, the windscreen folds down, the roof lifts off, the doors lift off. You can drive it anywhere, and it's just a fun vehicle. Every day I get into it, I smile. It brings a smile on my face, and I just enjoy it. My missus loves it. She won't drive it. All the arches are too flared, and she feels uncomfortable. But for me, I love it to death.
So over the years, what's been your fave?
Mm.
I really, really adored my Plymouth Prowler. However, it was so ostentatious. I used to get people undertaking and overtaking, you filming out the windows of what the car was. I had one person standing by it when I returned once, and they were waiting for me to come back just to say, what is it? How much is it worth? Where do I get one? And it was stunning, but it was just too much of an attention-seeking car. So I adored that. I did bring over a Chevrolet SSR, which is a pickup truck,
right?
But it's got a cover over the flatbed, so it's not really a truck. It was like a modern day version of a hot rod. And I bought that brand spanking new. So what happens is, America, if a wheel touches the pavement or the roads in America, then a tax has to be paid. So I bought this one from a dealer, and the dealer had to low load it and drive it to the ferry terminals on a low loader so that we could avoid this tax.
Yeah.
And he explained the situation to me. So it was shipped, although it's an American car and I imported it from America, it's never once had its wheels on the road in America legally.
Is that right?
Right, yeah.
It was shipped over. But then you've got to have a thing called an SVA done, single vehicle approval, which is it's like an MOT on steroids. It's awful. And if anything's not quite right, they have to put them right. But as soon as it passes its SVA, you can take all those bits off. So, for example, on my Plymouth Prowler, I had to have the headlights can't be more than 400 millimetres from the edges of the wings. Well, on the Plymouth Prowler, it very much points inwards, and the headlights are here, and your arches stick right out.
Mm.
So the guy at the SVA who was organising it for me, he put metal brackets on, he got old headlights from motorbike, put them on, and he wired them up, and it went into the test, and the guy said, dip beam, main beam, yep, they work. Tick, 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 it passed. You take them off, throw them in a skip, and then you can carry on driving it. And it passes its MOT, that's not a problem, but it's just the SVA. But the beauty of the SSR is it was a V8, and you could have it in a 5.3 or a 6-litre. I got the 6-litre. It was a 400 brake horsepower. Yeah. Two-seater car with a tiny little metal roof that folded down behind the seats. And it was such a beast to drive. Can you imagine 400 brake in a two-seater truck? Mm. And I absolutely loved it. But, you know, I was in London living in SW4 at the time, and nobody in London likes big cars anymore. You get snide remarks. No one lets you out side roads. And, you know, you hear about cars getting vandalised now if you've got the big Chelsea tractors. And I used to get comments about it, and in the end I had to let it go. But, it certainly wasn't doing the planet any good.
Well, funnily enough, actually, that links on very nicely to what I was just thinking, in so much as I think we're getting an impression of, you know, sort of what floats your boat car-wise. Have you ever been down the electric route, and would you ever go down the electric route?
I don't think we're going to have a lot of choice in a few years' time. It's either that or hydrogen. I'm not a big fan of electric at the moment, but I was saying that I have got three cyber trucks on order. Have you heard of the Tesla cyber trucks?
Yeah.
As soon as I saw it being advertised on YouTube by Elon Musk. If you haven't watched it, watch it, because his demonstration of this car goes wrong. And
is that when he does the window?
That's the window. You've seen it, Jason. It's hilarious. But I just remember seeing the vehicle and thought, that is amazing. It's beautiful. Now, they do three versions. They do a 1, 2, or 3 engine version. And I thought, I'm going to get on the waiting list for this nice and early. Yeah. Now, the beauty is you only got to put £100 down to place an order. And you can have that money back any time up to 2 weeks after delivery. That's the law. So I went and ordered one of each, and I thought at the time, you know, what I do is when they're arriving, if there's a 5-year waiting list for them, I'll cash in and flog a couple and get the third one free of charge. But when you read the T's and C's, and believe it or not, I did read the T's and C's, it actually says that you can't sell your waiting list, or you can't sell them for up to 2 weeks after taking delivery. So to own them, you've got to buy them, and then you can sell them. But I don't want three. I only want to keep one, probably the triple engine version. And that might be when I eventually step into the electric car market. Other than that, I just think they're boring, they're quiet. Cars have lost their character, they've lost their sex appeal. You know, they just... I haven't bought into electric yet. You know, that's basically... Maybe the Cybertruck is what will do it for me.
Yeah. No,
have you seen it, Dave?
No, I haven't.
It's quite an unbelievable looking thing.
Yeah,
it's a bit kind of Lamborghini-esque, isn't it? In that
it's very angular. It's got very sharp edges. In the demonstration, they fire a 9mm gun into the side panel, and the bullet bounces off. They got a bodybuilder smashing a 9-pound sledgehammer into the door panels, and it bounces off. And they got this beautiful electric four-wheel, like a quad bike, and it's designed for the Cybertruck, and it drives into the back, and then you plug it into the Cybertruck, and that recharges your quad bike. And it's just brutal. Jay Leno has been out test driving it, and it's lovely. Whether it will look the same when it comes to this country, because we probably have to be modified, I don't know. But for me, I'm quite excited about it. And a couple of my friends have all ordered them as well. But, you know, when they come out, Jason, you want to do a review, rather than down and borrow mine.
It's definitely causing a stir, isn't it? When do they reckon delivery might be?
Oh, if you go onto Facebook, there's groups over there saying, you know, they're coming out and there's something, people have spotted them supposedly. I haven't heard from Tesla yet. I think the earliest will be next year. But the waiting list on it is massive now.
Wow.
But I'll have at least two for sale, guys. We can have one each.
I get the T's and C's. Just get them swapped out.
Exactly. Well, there's ways around everything, isn't there?
What are they going to do? He's not going to come after you, is he? He's not going to.
And remember, Jason, T's and C's aren't law.
Exactly. There we go. See?
Yeah.
Dom, I was going to ask you what your two-car fantasy garage would be made up from, but I think you might already have it, or at least have it on order, no? Or is there something that you've always really fancied getting your hands on?
Yeah, a 1958 Corvette Stingray, the little two-seater one. You know the ones that have got the tailpipes coming out of the rear quarter bumpers?
Yeah.
I'll probably go for the traditional red and cream colour. Just a stunning-looking, gorgeous car. A decent one will cost you an arm and a leg now. You wouldn't find one less than probably about 80-90 grand.
Wow.
I've always liked them. That for me would be my fantasy car that I haven't yet owned but would like to.
Yeah, mate, I raced one of those at Goodwood at the Revival. A big block one. And it's the scariest, frightening thing I've ever raced in my entire life. It's absolutely mental.
Yeah.
It turns like a Townsend Torreson ferry. It stops as
that's American for you.
God, how does it go that way?
I did actually have a 74 Corvette Stingray convertible when I was young, a small block one. It was a 350, but it's a manual. And exactly the same, Jason. Great car, lovely looking, but it drove like an old donkey. He really did.
Yeah. I mean, they're great.
I remember you racing that, Jace, and I remember kind of like watching it, and you were saying afterwards, just trying to keep the thing, you know, sort of round those court was just, you know, you were wrestling with it, weren't you?
Mate, fourth gear at 100, over 100 mile an hour, you can light the rears up.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous. Awesome, I mean, it literally is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And amusingly, I've raced it quite a few years now at Goodwood. And, you know, every finger and toes crossed that it's not going to rain. And it did rain one year, and I'm thinking, Jesus. But you know what? It was actually easier in the wet because you just knew what it was going to do.
Yeah.
And the grip level was so low.
Yeah.
I basically just left it in third gear and didn't use anything more than like 30% throttle because it was pointless.
Yeah.
And it was great. It was actually more fun in the wet than it is in the dry.
Because you know it's going to slide.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it's the fastest thing in the TT, which is the big race at Goodwood. It's the quickest thing at the end of the straight. And going into the last, the penultimate corner, we're doing 165 mile an hour in it.
Wow.
And it's still going.
Yeah.
And I'm braking much earlier than I could or should.
Yeah.
Just because I'm thinking this is just too much. It's really frightening to drive.
But that's the thing, isn't it? You know, it's one thing going that speed in a straight line, but actually knowing or rather being unsure of the stopping capacity. That's what must scare you.
It doesn't stop. You know? You just get on the brakes and then it starts vibrating. You remember when you used to do the cross chat John O'Fair Ferries and you'd walk past where all the booze was kept?
Yeah.
And it was that vibration of bottles and stuff. That's the noise it makes when you get on the brakes.
And that's the beauty of a VA engine, isn't it? What do we get now when you've got an electric car? You can't even hear the things pulling away. It's pretty boring, but unfortunately we're destined to be driving them sooner or later.
Well, I've got a feeling we won't actually. I think e-fuels are coming, and we'll be able to use the petrol stations again because it'll be an e-fuel, and we'll be able to get rid of this nonsense that is the electric car generation. Even though I present an electric car show, it's just not so sustainable. Most people in the UK don't have driveways. They live on streets or in flats or apartments. Well, they can't have electric cars.
Yeah.
They just simply can't.
Yeah.
And they're too expensive. E-fuels all the way, and then we can have our V8s.
Exactly.
It should be law. We should all have to drive them.
Let's be honest, the carbon footprint from any vehicle is not as great as what people think they is. If you do your homework, it ain't that great, is it?
No, absolutely, absolutely. Well, listen, before we depress ourselves all about electric cars, there's one question, Dominic Littlewood, that we ask everybody. Jason, over to you. Hit them with the final question.
We reckon that music and cars just are perfect together. So we want to know your fancy drive. So where are you? Where are you going? What are you listening to? And most importantly, what are you driving?
It would be Ram Jam by Black Betty. Mm-hmm. I'll be driving from San Francisco down to LA, but I wouldn't be taking the coastal route. I'd go inland, which I have actually done. And I would be driving, I would probably say, a Plymouth Prowler again or my Cybertruck when it arrives.
Yay!
Did I answer all the questions?
You did. You answered all of them perfectly. And it was a pleasure to have it all delivered. And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
So, unfortunately, that is it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Thanks, Dave, as always, to you. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Mr. Dominic Littlewood. Thanks, mate.
And thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure, guys.
No, thanks, Dom. It's been really, really good. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plater or at David Bitty. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll see you next time. Ta-da.